everybody. Welcome to another episode of Supernatural George. I'm Mittens, and today we're going to be talking about Season 8, Episode 3, Heartache, written by Brad Buckner and Eugenie Ross Lemming, and directed by Jensen Ackles, which means that this episode was filmed first of the season, out of order, because Jensen directed it. Which also explains why Sam and Dean suddenly have deep golden suntans, since Jensen and Jared had just come back from their summer vacation. And they faded before we got to the first episode of the season, which is probably good, because Dean didn't seem like he was getting much of a tan in purgatory. I do enjoy seeing Jensen's dad make a cameo in this episode, though, even if he's only there for a minute or two. I am far less excited to spend the episode having flashbacks to Sam and Amelia, because nothing can possibly make their relationship interesting to me, but we'll get to that eventually. Let's start with the heart imagery that really begins in earnest here. It's been tied to Dean going back as far, at least, as Season 1, Episode 12, Faith. Remember when a Reaper was forced to heal Dean's dying heart by doing a magical transplant from an openly gay man? Yeah, well, we're about to give Dean all sorts of new and interesting heart-related issues. Eventually, they'll be paired up with handprint imagery, too, for some reason. Other than that, there's just a lot of discomfort in this one for me, since eye horror is at the top of my personal squick list. So we're just going to try and get through this one with the least amount of damage inflicted, I guess. There is a deleted scene on the DVD where Eleanor leaves something on Brick's gravestone late at night, and I'm honestly not even sure where it was supposed to fall within the episode, but that is the entire scene, her walking up to his grave, putting something there, and then walking away. It doesn't even specify in the transcript what it is she's leaving behind. But that transcript is part of the transcript on the Super Wiki if you'd like to read it for yourself. So with that, let's get into the then segment. Because we are racing through this one. It's Buck Lemming, folks. We open with the reminder that Sam had stopped hunting for a year, just abandoned everything, for a girl. We're reminded of Amelia, the hostile vet, and the dog that Sam hit, and then walked out on in the middle of the night without so much as a howdy-do. Then we're flung back to mid-season 7, and Professor Morrison, who unwittingly helped them out with the Amazon case. Then Kevin Tran and the new demon tablet. Dean asks how many words of God there are, and Kevin is the human shrug emoji about it. Kevin now knows how to make demon-killing bombs, though. But after last week's episode, he's now on the run with Linda and who knows where they are. And that has triggered Sam's long-buried feelings of responsibility toward Kevin, and now he's very worried about Kevin's safety after he himself had abandoned Kevin for an entire year. Which brings us to now in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where our cold open victim is jogging late one night. He gets passed by a far less fit-looking dude who just flies past him. And when our poor hapless jogger finally catches up to the other guy again, he extends a gracious hand and compliments the guy in a friendly fashion. The far less fit-looking dude just tells him that he does a lot of cardio before jamming a hand into the other dude's chest and ripping out his heart. This is cardio monster style. And then we cut to the title card. And doesn't the heartbeat sound effect over the title card feel just extra ominous this week? Because, yeah, hearts are a big theme this season, with Alfie saying that Cass's problem was always too much heart last week, and Dean suffering some heartbreak about Cass stuck in purgatory still, and now hearts are literally getting ripped out. Anyway, post-title card, we cut to Sam stealing an apple from a farmer's market stall and just eating it without paying for it. I'm only judging him a little bit because it is a red delicious apple, which is probably the least delicious of all the apple varieties. Sorry to any Red Delicious apple enjoyers out there. You're just wrong. Dean is on his phone, already finding cases that he missed while he was in purgatory for a year. He mentions the jogger from the cold open and another identical murder 6 months earlier. He knows it's a case and suggests to Sam that they go investigate. Sam argues that they're already on a case. Kevin and the tablet need to be found, so the heart-ripping monster needs to wait. Dean argues back that they've been looking for Kevin for a week and had no luck. And where are they even? He looks around and it's like a farmer's market. Sam has apparently learned to appreciate the good things in life, like organic fruit, during his year off hunting. But Dean makes the extremely valid point that they can't just let innocent people die so that Sam can stop and smell the roses. I mean, he now feels extremely guilty for not having looked for Kevin sooner, and basically flat out said he doesn't feel guilty about all the other people he declined to help on his year off, even while keeping an eye on the news for what he knew were their kind of cases. He just assumed somebody else would handle them. But Dean just can't ignore them and then still live with himself. But Sam relents, and they head to Minneapolis, where Jensen's dad is the detective that they meet with. It really had to be strange acting across from your dad like this, or conversely, across from your son like this. Dean tries to prod the detective about the, quote, chubby guy caught on surveillance footage passing the dead jogger. And the detective gets defensive about how they thoroughly checked the guy out and couldn't believe he was capable of physically just ripping out anyone's heart with his bare hands. Sam has to break into their glaring contest to ask where they can find this guy anyway. We find Paul, the jogging heart snatcher, at home mixing up health smoothies. Dean comes in from the bathroom and makes the joke about having eaten too much fiber, and Sam agrees with Paul that there's no such thing, which just feels all kinds of wrong. But they move on from that. Sam points out that the other jogger was a good deal younger and fitter looking, and this guy just blew past him. Paul says he had a health scare about a year ago, and ever since he's started taking better care of himself. Hence the disgusting smoothies he's drinking and the carefully plotted fitness regimen that he does. Later, they sit at a cafe where visually it looks like Dean's being haunted by a hovering ghost of a slice of pie. It's just the cafe's logo painted on the window, but I personally find it amusing. He doesn't get real pie, he just gets ghost of pie floating in front of him. Sam asks what Dean found, poking around in Paul's house. But there was nothing spooky, no hex bags, no other sort of occult objects. Dean then discovers another identical murder 2 days after the murder they're currently looking into in Iowa, which Paul couldn't possibly have committed because he was being interviewed by the police at the time. Someone has been arrested for that crime, though, a man who had been a police officer himself. Dean also discovers the exact same thing happened 6 months ago in Iowa as well, and gets snarky with Sam about how he must have just missed that. So they drive to Iowa to interview the new killer. The officer that they interview knew the guy, because he was a 20-year veteran of the force. One night he'd just ordered a pizza, then ripped the heart out of the delivery driver and just left his body out on his own front porch. They found the police officer curled up on the porch, covered in blood, crying about what he'd done. And because that officer had been in court testifying all week, there's no way he could have been responsible for the Minneapolis murder either. So they have at least two killers killing in the exact same way. When they go to actually talk to Officer Swenson, he only keeps staring out into space, acting all twitchy, and chanting the same indecipherable phrase over and over again. They try to ask him why he killed the guy, But Officer Swenson becomes distressed, slams his hands on the table, and just keeps chanting. Dean points out that the man seems to have two different colored eyes, and then sprinkles the guy with holy water to no effect, so he's not possessed. But they are clearly not getting anything helpful out of him. Later that night in his cell, we see Swenson pull a piece of metal from his bunk and then hear him, from outside the door, ram it into his own eye. And ew, we are just going to gloss over that bit and be grateful that, even though the scene was filmed, the network decided that it was just too gory to actually show us him chopping out his own eye, which I personally am eternally grateful for. At their motel room, Sam is listening to a recording of what Swenson was chanting. Dean's all proud of himself for having bought a translation app for his phone, and Sam tries to mock him for it a little bit, but the app also does not recognize the language. That's when they get the call about Swenson and head to the hospital to talk to his doctor. Once again, Sam is using a Bon Jovi alias, Agent Sambora. Why does he keep choosing that one for himself? I mean, it's the alias that Meg picked for him way back when she possessed him. You'd think he'd have sworn off it after that, but no. Anyway, hospital, doctor. Dean asks her if this was some sort of psychotic break, and she thinks so. Swenson was very thorough removing his eye, and the doctor has a hard time believing that he was physically strong enough to have ripped that piece of metal free to do it, too. Which fits with folks back in Minneapolis not thinking Paul, the health nut, was strong enough to rip a man's heart out of his chest. He'd had an accident almost a year ago to the day and lost his eye, so he had a new one transplanted. And that was the eye that he's cut out now. Dean asks if it's possible to trace a donated organ back to the donor, and the doctor says it's difficult, but possible. Back at the motel, Dean comes in to find Sam having looked into Paul's health crisis the previous year. He also had an organ transplant almost exactly a year ago. Sam also emailed an audio file of Swenson's chanting to Dr. Morrison to see if he recognized the language. Dean suggests that they head out on the road because 6 months ago, there was a third murder in Boulder, Colorado. So that might be where the next murder will happen. And I do appreciate Dean not remembering who Dr. Morrison was at first because, oh my God, he hated that guy when they first met him, and Sam was the one who was all gung-ho about him being useful to them, but thank goodness I think this is the last time we even get a mention of him in the series, so bye-bye. We then cut to Boulder, Colorado, by the rear entry to a strip club called the Bunny Hole. A creepy-looking guy waits as one of the dancers steps outside. She takes his arm and they walk down the alley, and he tells her that he doesn't normally do this sort of thing, and for a tense second we think he's obviously about to rip out her heart, but she turns and pushes him up against the wall and then rips out his heart. Aren't Buck Lemmings so edgy and fresh, switching up expectations like that? Girl power, or strong independent woman, or something. I don't know. Anyway, we then cut back to Dean driving the Impala through the night, poking at Sam. He feels like this case is coming together and that it's getting him and Sam back on the same page after all their difficulties. Sam's not really paying much attention, though, so Dean goes on about the perspective he's gained over the last year in purgatory and then since he's been back. He believes he's at his best when he's hunting with Sam, riding shotgun. Sam seems to agree at first, but then suggests that maybe Dean would be better off hunting on his own. Sam's not exactly bailing on Dean, but he's putting the idea out there that maybe they want different things out of life. which is a very good and valid observation. They do want different things out of life. But the way Sam goes about saying it here is objectively not the best. Sorry you had to say so much Buck Lemming dialogue, Sam. Sam tells Dean that he wants his life to count for something. Dean's about to get angry about this. Like what? Hunting doesn't count for anything? All these people we saved, they don't count for anything? And from us, the repeat viewer audience, we have to question Sam's sanity about this statement, because what exactly was he doing that was so important during his year with Amelia? Fixing motel ice makers and garbage disposals? Sort of drifting through a fantasy of what a normal life is, and deliberately ignoring people who probably died because he couldn't be fussed to help them? And I get him not wanting to be dragged into the hunting life, but the universe is just not going to let him off the hook. Dean doesn't get an answer to his question because his phone rings. The doctor in Iowa has learned that both men's transplanted organs came from football superstar Brick Holmes. Can we laugh at that alias for a second? That he was a brick house? Okay. But he died in a car crash about a year ago and donated a total of 8 organs. None of the recipients were from Boulder, but since Brick had lived there, they're still gonna head there, despite Sam's displeasure with this plan. We then cut back to the stripper, Randa, saying the same chant that Swenson the one-eyed cop had been, but she's really getting into it, painting blood on her face, and then taking a bite of the heart that she ripped out. And then she's surrounded by some sort of magical energy that sets her own heart glowing, and then her eyes glow red. So that's obviously something very ominous and bad. The next day, Sam and Dean meet with Brick Holmes' mother, supposedly. Sam is in awe of Brick, knew all of his stats. He was a hero to Sam when he was a teenager, kind of idolized the guy. And Mrs. Holmes says something curious, that Brick lived for competition and athletic perfection. And she doesn't think it occurred to his fans that he was human like the rest of us. Like she has to reassure herself of that fact after what we already know is the truth about him. Sam asks if she'd known Brick was an organ donor, and she gets a little squirrely, so he assures her that they're just following up on another matter. So she answers that Brick filled out the form because he never thought he was going to die. And she is being so much more literal than she's letting on here. Dean speculates about how Brick could have died the way he did, driving off a bridge in a way that seemed almost intentional, and Mrs. Holmes defensively insists that it was an accident. Sam asks about Brick's personal life, if he was married, and Mrs. Holmes says he was only married to the game. Dean asks if he had any new interests in his life lately, like fly fishing, stamp collecting, or the occult, which again gives Mrs. Holmes pause, and she makes an excuse to leave. After they've been ushered out, even Sam comments on how she was evasive about their questions, and then Dean gets a notification on his phone that, yes, there has been an identical murder in Boulder, conveniently right where they already are. When they drive away, we cut back inside the house where Mrs. Holmes runs into Randa, our stripper-slash-heart-eating murderer, and they have a cryptic chat where Mrs. Holmes assures her that she is being careful about what she says, and Randa says she just wants to protect Brick, all while creepy and ominous music plays. Brick's heart still beats inside Randa's chest, and it's why she moved to Boulder, to watch out for Eleanor the way Brick did. So let's talk about hearts, and what this episode seems to be trying to say about hearts, despite how that might look with all of us knowing that Dean Winchester has the heart of a dead, openly gay teacher. Anyway, I'm not going to divert into that entire talk yet. We're going to save that for the end. But we are putting a pin in that so everybody can think about that through this whole episode. Back at their motel, Sam gets off the phone with Professor Morrison, who identified the language that the cop had been chanting as ancient Mayan. It's a prayer to the god Cacao, and they now suspect that god is somehow possessing these people. Next up on the hit list, someone in Phoenix is due to have their heart ripped out if the plan from 6 months ago is still on track. Only the man who got one of Brick's organs who lives in Phoenix has gone missing, a man named Jimmy Tong. And I think it's really interesting that they chose the name Jimmy here, when the only other Jimmy we really know about in canon. I mean, when you hear the name Jimmy on Supernatural, who do you think about? Everybody thinks about Jimmy Novak. Anyway, I just wanted to point out that that's the other man's name, because he does show up later. But kudos to Dean for at least ballparking the Mayan culture at about 1,000 years ago. I love tiny reminders like that, that Dean is not ignorant, no matter what Sam likes to say about him. But after Dean relates that info, he brings up another email he found in their inbox from a university answering questions about admissions. Sam brushes it off, tries not to answer, just says he's looking at options. And Dean asks if he really is seriously considering quitting hunting. Sam doubles down on the whole just looking at options thing, and then, with just a smidge of resentment, asks if they're going to Phoenix now to chase their tails until the missing guy shows up. Because it's clear that Sam really does not want to be doing this hunt, even when his interest is piqued even a tiny bit here and there, and he is actively participating. It's almost grudgingly so. Dean insists that no, they're staying in Boulder, because he knows there's more that Eleanor Holmes wasn't telling them. As Dean gets up and goes into the bathroom, he gets all grumpy with Sam and says, like, nice job changing the subject there, though. There's clearly a lot of unspoken resentment from both of them at this point. Later that night, they head back to the Holmes residence and break in. They've only got until 10 p.m. when the ceremony that Eleanor went to is scheduled to end. In the master bedroom, Dean finds Brick's closet and his hair bleach. He wasn't a natural blonde. Across the room, Sam is confused to find what seems to be Eleanor's closet, containing the outfit that she'd been wearing earlier that day, which kind of creeps them both right out, because Buck Lemming has just got to make it weird. Back in Brick's closet, Dean finds a secret hidden room filled with 1,000 years worth of sporting memorabilia. Among all the trophies and things, they find an old box filled with love letters all addressed to Dearest Betsy and signed Love Me. They span decades, covering a boxing career through a baseball career, a car racing career, until Sam finally finds a very recent letter that says, "So tired of it all," almost like a suicide note. Back in their motel, they're researching everything that they found in that closet, pulling the names from his trophies, and Sam discovers that Brick wasn't a collector of sports memorabilia. It was all his, reinventing himself every few decades and starting in a different sport. Sam wrestles with how Brick lived his life like that, disappearing and reinventing himself as a new person over and over again. It kind of feels like a long-scale version of Sam and his repeated desire to just pick up stakes and run away from his life of hunting. You know, he may not have changed his name, but he certainly did lie about his entire history, trying to pretend he was just normal guy, completely reinventing himself and pretending his past life didn't exist at all. Meanwhile, Dean is researching Mayan culture, where torture, conquest, and sports were all central, and Mayan athletes honored Cacao by killing a victim, pulling out his heart, and then eating it. And apologies to the entirety of Mayan culture for how it's portrayed in Supernatural. I guess I should have put a disclaimer at the beginning of this one for world religions and belief systems, but yeah, it's buck lemming on top of that. Jeez. Anyway, Sam wonders what else Brick had to do to stay young forever, because immortality wasn't part of the usual cacao ritual sacrifice. Maybe strength and performance was, but immortality, not so much. Dean says it's not like they hadn't heard of other people selling themselves out to gods or demons or the like, and points out that maybe all that old sports equipment was actually Brick's, and maybe he was himself 1,000 years old. Sam extrapolates that the people who got Brick's organs inadvertently inherited his deal as well, which Dean likens to being bitten by a werewolf. Maybe you don't have a choice but to continue carrying out the ritual, especially if you like the results. And that one cop couldn't handle it and ripped out the offending organ. Sam's kind of disappointed that his childhood hero was a heart-eating monster, but he is kind of relieved that it means that Brick wasn't actually sleeping with his own mother. He finds a photo of Brick and Eleanor when they were still known as Kelly Duran, boxer, and his loving wife, Betsy. And suddenly, they know exactly what Eleanor was so desperately trying not to tell them. The next day, they go back to her house and tell her they know she's Betsy. She grudgingly lets them in and tells them the whole truth. She didn't know that people were still dying because of the organ transplants. And now, instead of 2 people dying per year, 16 people are being killed. Or 15 now that Eye Guy ripped out his eye. She thought it would be over when Brick died, but she did know about Brick, and she tells them his story. And it's clear as she talks that she truly loved him, and that having lost him truly pains her. Even knowing exactly who and what he was, and what he did. She didn't learn about the deal he made with the god Cacao until after she began to age and Brick, or Kelly at the time, didn't. But by that time, they were both changed by knowing one another. They were deeply in love, and when she learned how he stayed young, who he really was, she chose to ignore it. But Brick had changed too. And as she aged, she was his wife, and then a woman he kept hidden away, and then she had to publicly play his mother. They had both become tired of that life, though. It was a huge burden for them to bear. And when Brick realized that she was growing near to the end of her natural lifespan, he couldn't take it anymore. For centuries before he met her, he'd been all alone, and he couldn't bear the thought of continuing on with that life without her anymore. So he drove off that bridge, intentionally. The problem now is that there are 8 killers for the Winchesters to deal with, not just one. But Eleanor says that might not be true. Brick always told her that the heart was the key, the focus of the sacrifice. So if they can stop that heart, it would be over. And of course, we know who has Brick's heart. Randa, at the bunny hole. I think this is the appropriate time to talk about that heart imagery in this episode. Despite all the other people who got Brick's organs feeling the same compulsion to sacrifice to Cacao and benefiting from carrying those rituals out, only the heart really matters in the end. Brick himself was ready to let go of his own immortality in the name of love, not wanting to live without his beloved Betsy. She changed him, taught him what it really means to be human, alive, and in love. And doesn't that all sound painfully, horribly familiar? All while Dean and Eleanor here are trauma bonding over losing people that they loved. And the heart is key. Follow your heart, Dean. It'll lead you to happiness. how much heart imagery gets attached to both Dean and Cass through the rest of the series, because it's a lot. How many times does Dean almost die because of his heart? Ba-boom, 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 as the hallucination of Lilith tries to squeeze his heart way back in yellow fever. And then he actually does die when he gets slammed up against some rusty rebar that pierces his heart. Which kind of feels like the stupidest form of betrayal, doesn't it? I promised myself I would not yell about the series finale, despite the onslaught of heart references in this one. And we are officially moving on. But you all know, I'm in yelling inside of my heart about it. Okay. When they pull up to the bunny hole, we hear a train going past nearby, loudly honking its horn and ringing a very persistent bell. And that's a pretty convenient danger warning. While they're in the car, Sam and Dean both wonder if Eleanor was right about this. And Sam wonders if Brick thought that he'd be incinerated by that car crash and wouldn't have to worry about his organs carrying on without him. And Dean is sort of matter of fact, almost like he's put out about having to go through this in the first place. That he didn't actually burn to nothing, which is why they have to go kill someone else now. So they take their big knives and head inside. Dean picks the lock on the back door of the club and they find the dancers' locker room. Dean, of course, makes a comment about it, about the smell of the room, like he's savoring it. Because, of course, Buck Lemming require him to be gross, and they require for Sam to comment about how gross Dean is. Out in the main room, Randa is waiting for them. She knows Eleanor gave her up and implies that she's going to kill Eleanor for that as soon as she's finished killing Sam and Dean. Funny that the main beer sign on display in this club is Margie Kugel, the family beer, the mom beer. We also get a partial shot of Dean standing beside a Lonzo's Lager sign, which is the longing beer. Famously, it also hangs in the gas and sip in 9-6 between Dean and Cass when he's trying to convince Cass to go hunting with him. And then it's also hanging in the bar in 15-19 while Dean is very sad and wearing Cass's bloody handprint on his shoulder. And here it is in the episode about hearts being literally ripped out. So, you know, take from that what you will. I'm trying not to talk about the finale, okay? I'm really trying. Randa is not alone there, though. Paul the health nut from the cold open, as well as the missing Jimmy Tong from Phoenix, are both there. And they are both very much stronger than they look. They manage to fling Sam across the room and knock him out. And then they both pin Dean down onto the stage at Randa's feet. Paul is clearly delighted with his newfound strength, and all three of them, Paul, Jimmy, and Randa, gladly sacrifice to Cacao now, which gives us an excuse to hear Randa's tale. Before, she was just a shy and awkward girl from Georgia with a heart condition, but after, she became like Xena Warrior Princess. She describes the killings she does now as better than sex, and does so while straddling Dean, fondling his chest and saying that if she goes slow enough, she can show him his still beating heart before he dies. Because Buck Lemming loved to inflict heart-related sexual violence on Dean. They're going to do it again next season, too. Once is not enough for them. Anyway, Randa starts pressing her fingers into Dean's chest, when Sam runs up and smashes a bottle over Paul's head, and in the ensuing melee, Dean manages to stab Randa through the heart. Her whole body begins to glow, and Paul and Jimmy each have a similar flash of red light over their hearts before dropping dead, and then Randa dies. I guess the other four organ recipients we never met also simultaneously dropped dead, wherever they happen to be. I only wonder if the cop in Iowa who ripped his eye out was spared. He's in for a pretty awful time for the rest of his life either way. Later, They go tell Eleanor that it's all over. She's content with this. She half expected them to fail and for Rand to show up at her door to kill her, but either way would have been fine with her because she's at peace now. As they're driving out of town that night, Dean is happy. They finally got the win. He then tells Sam that he kind of understands what Randa was saying about being a warrior. He gets it. And Sam answers that he knows Dean does, but he doesn't. And Sam once again tries to warn Dean that when it's over, when they find Kevin in the tablet and shut hell forever, that Sam is done. He's out. Dean tries to suggest that Sam doesn't really mean that, but Sam is adamant. And this is where Buck Lemming apparently gives Sam amnesia, or some sort of weird personality transplant. Maybe delusions. I have no idea. But he tells Dean that during the year that he took off, he had something that he never did before. He got to have a normal life, to see what it felt like, and he wants it back now. And just, okay, but what was that whole Stanford education that he had pre-series? Was that not a normal life? When he was pretending that he was just some guy and living with Jess and applying to law school. Did he completely forget her and that whole life that he led for several years? I mean, they say 2 years in the show, even though Kripke has said, yeah, he forgot to go back and edit it to 4 years. But 4 years he had, living a totally normal life without anything hanging over him, while still believing that his father and his brother were still alive out there fighting the good fight. But this is what he says is the first time he's had a really normal life. What is it? Because he knew that his father and his brother couldn't come back and pull him back into the life again? Did he finally feel truly free? There's a lot of reasons why season 8 to me feels like a true reboot back to the start. And this is a big one of those reasons. This is an issue that Sam has struggled with throughout season 1. And long afterward, which drove him to do awful things out of guilt. It's just a core aspect of Sam's character. He keeps wanting to run away, but the story won't let him. Until he realizes that again and recommits to living the life that he has, or to accepting who he actually is, instead of the soft focus golden glow of a fake life that he thinks he wants instead. Speaking of which, while Sam ignores Dean in the car, we cut to his soft focus golden glow of a flashback to his life with Amelia. He's walking across a bridge in a park with his dog, looking for Amelia and unable to find her. Eventually, Riot the dog finds her, where she's set up a surprise happy birthday picnic for Sam. He seems delighted by this, and I'd like to point out how similar this almost fake-feeling flashback is to the vision that Dean had way back in Season 3, Episode 10, while he and Sam were both on African Dream Route, where Lisa was the woman waiting for Dean with a picnic ready, exactly like this. I argued back during that episode of this podcast that it didn't even feel like Dean's dream, but more like the dream that Sam wanted Dean to have, you know? And guess why it really feels that way to me? Because of that awful promise Sam forced from Dean in 522, combined with Sam's literal fantasy scenario here, where he doubles down on wanting that life back. We know how awful that life went for Dean back in season 6, when he tried to live it with Lisa. And even with the mess that Sam walked away from with Amelia, he still wants that life back, more than he wants to keep hunting right now. This has just been your occasional reminder that Sam and Dean are very different people with very different hopes and desires for the future. Sam's vision fades and we cut back to the Impala at night, and Sam looking really sad that he gave up his life with Amelia to ride with Dean again. And that is where this episode ends. I think it's just really interesting that this episode, where all the heart and love imagery could have very easily tied into Sam and how he's missing Amelia and that life with her that he'd left behind, but it doesn't at all. All of it was put on Dean himself, when the only thing that he's missing, really, is Cass. And Cass isn't even mentioned in this episode at all. Not even in the then segment. How curious, though, that Dean is the one who gets all the reaction shots to Eleanor's emotional pain on losing Brick. And Dean is the one who nearly gets his heart ripped out. But isn't Sam the one suffering a broken heart about leaving Amelia? No, Sam just gets knocked out for a few minutes. He may have a slight concussion. Which is kind of how all of his flashbacks to Amelia feel. But isn't Sam the one suffering a broken heart about leaving Amelia? The woman throwing him sunshiny picnics with birthday cake and a dog that feel barely relevant to anything? And mainly serve as a sort of pipe dream of a normal life for Sam? They had the opportunity here to actually make his feelings for Amelia seem real, to give depth to the relationship Sam had been building and then walked away from for Dean. They could have made that a painful loss that we all felt for him, but instead, they don't do that at all. She's just kind of tacked on to the end of the episode like a warm, fuzzy afterthought. And it somehow makes her and Sam's entire year of running away feel even less real. Oh well. At least we get something completely different to focus on in the next episode. Season 8, Episode 4, Bitten. I personally love the outsider POV we get on most of this episode. I know the fandom is kind of divided about it, but I find it refreshing. And it gives us interesting new insight into the tenuous working relationship that Sam and Dean have been working on since Dean came back from Purgatory. Anyway, until then, you can find me on Tumblr at MittensMorgul or at SPNGeorge. You can find me on Discord and Blue Sky as MittensMorgul, or you can email me at MittensMorgul@gmail.com. And I look forward to talking to everybody again real soon. And I keep getting further and further ahead with my recordings of these. I'm like 3 weeks ahead now. And I keep realizing that I'm actually missing occasional things here and there just because I am so far ahead of what's actually being broadcast out there. Or I'll forget a detail that gets revealed in a later episode and I'll catch it as the previous episode that I messed up on was airing. So like, oh well. I'm very lazy and I'm never going to bother to correct any of those. I mean, it's not even like really significant stuff. It's just like an offhanded comment that, oops, I was wrong about it. It didn't happen in that episode, or it happened slightly differently or in a different order or whatever. Whatever. I swear it's nothing really earth-shattering, but it bothered me enough to say it out loud here. So there you go. Even Spiders George occasionally eats crow. And on that note, I have a good one, everyone.